Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. You know, over the past few years, there have been a select few stories that have, if nothing else, piqued the interest of news junkies and those of us in the media. There, of course, was the revelation that the state was investing in rare coins, of all things. There were the Dancers for Democracy who were opposed to strip club regulations. And now there is the Columbus casino fight. First, there was the fight for and against the casino in the Arena District. Voters settled that one. Then there was the move to the west side of Columbus, and the voters allowed that to happen. Now there's a fight over annexation, tax incentives. The city won't give it water, so the casino will drill, it says. The county took the casino's sewer service away, so the casino now proposes trucking it to Marysville or burying it deep underground. The twists and turns of this story seem to be endless. Here to give us an update on the Columbus Casino is Bob Tenenbaum. He speaks for Penn National, which is the developer and would operate the Columbus Casino. Bob, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
We welcome your calls, 292-8513. Who do you blame for this casino fight? 292-8513. We did invite the mayor, also city council president Andrew Ginther, also the city's attorney, all declined our offer to take part in this program, citing pending litigation. We'll get into that in just a moment. Bob, the city wants the casino to annex a site in the west side where the Delphi plant was into the city of Columbus. It's now in a township. And the city wants the proceeds from the casino, obviously, and also the income tax revenue from the workers who would work there. The casino, Penn National, wants little help for agreeing to move the casino from the original site in the Arena District to the west side. Penn National gets about $400 million a year from its casino in Indiana, $400 million a year from its casino in West Virginia. You have to assume this one's going to get close to that. Why do you need tax incentives to build this?
Well, I should start by pointing out that we've actually moved beyond that. We are no longer seeking any help from anybody, really, to build this casino. Our goal now is to get shovels in the ground, get construction underway, hire the 3,500 construction workers we did hire last week, the Smoot Company of Columbus as the construction manager, get the casino built, open it on schedule toward the end of 2012, and hire the 2,000 permanent employees who will be working there.
So you're not seeking any tax incentives from the city now?
No. At this point, what we're seeking is, and we filed a federal lawsuit, as you know, we're seeking to get the city and the county to continue to provide water and sewer service to that site. This is not an instance where this is a new property where the city's being asked to provide water. There's been water and sewer service on that site. Sewer, I think, since the late 1940s, and city water since the early 1950s. This is a case of taking away something that's been on that site for decades.
But will you agree to annex the property to the city?
We're not. At this point, our goal is to build the casino where it stands. It is in Franklin Township. We are not seeking at this point anything from the city or the county except the right to have sewer and water service.
But if the city claims and Penn National had agreed originally to annex the property into the city of Columbus so the city of Columbus could take advantage of the proceeds from the casinos as part of the constitutional amendment and also the income tax revenue from the workers, you had said, okay, we'll annex, but give us some help. Is that still on the table?
There was an agreement that Penn National would annex to the city of Columbus in return for help from the city in recovering some of the really significant losses that Penn National took when it voluntarily agreed under great duress from the city and some of the property owners in the Arena District to finance the campaign to move the site to the west side. However, there was never a formal agreement. The assumption was, and the city's indication was, that it would provide some kind of assistance. It was not specified what that was, but Penn National's loss on the Arena District, if you include the cost of completing the environmental cleanup, is going to run somewhere around $40 million. In addition to which, it voluntarily agreed with voter approval to move to a site on the west side that was a notorious brownfield site that I think it's safe to say would not have been cleaned up. Penn National's now spent about $25 million in property acquisition and the cleanup of that site, which is virtually completed. But what really happened was that after the vote, which was almost a year ago, it was last May, the city's position became, we'll give you nothing, you annex to the city. Well, that's not a negotiation, that's an ultimatum.
So what will it take for Penn National to annex? That's what the city wants. The city wants you to annex the property into the city. What will it take for Penn National to annex that property into the city?
Our position now is we've gone beyond that. We have constitutional authority to build on that site. Mm-hmm. That site happens to be in Franklin Township.
So now your fight is water and sewer service.
Exactly.
How long do you expect? I mean, federal court is not known for its speedy process. How long is this going to take?
Well, late last week we did file a request for a preliminary injunction and for expedited hearings and discovery on the suit. So we're hoping this will move quickly.
Federal court, are they going to want to mess with this? This seems to be a local issue between you and the city of Columbus and the county, Franklin County.
Well,
why is this a federal court matter?
One of our claims in the lawsuit is that our rights under the U.S. Constitution, equal protection, to be specific, are being violated by both the city and the county.
Did Penn National consider doing this in state court, county court?
No, I think the feeling was that federal court was the appropriate place for this.
292-8513, if you have a question for Bob Tenenbaum. He speaks for Penn National Gaming. They, of course, are the developer of the planned Westside Columbus Casino. The project is more or less on hold, I guess, until the water and sewer gets straightened out. Bob?
Well, let me correct that assumption. We're expecting possibly even this week approval from the state of the of our request for building permits, which would allow us to begin work on the site.
But you don't have approval of your plan to. I mean, where does your proposal to drill a well for water, where does that stand, and where does your proposal to either truck the sewage to Marysville, if that is a possibility, or to drill deep underneath and send the sewage down there?
Well, for the time being, the federal lawsuit sort of makes that a moot question, because what we're asking the federal court to do is require the city and the county to continue to provide water and sewer service to the Delphi site.
But if that you don't get the approval from the court, what happens then?
Well, we're reasonably optimistic the court will rule in our favor, and I think beyond that it would just be speculation.
So you're hoping to break ground this spring?
Yes. The schedule has always been to break ground this spring and open in the latter part of 2012.
You've hired a contractor, Smoot Construction, the region's largest certified minority-owned business.
So, and also one of the largest general contractors in the city.
So you've met two of the things you promised. One is that you would hire a local contractor, and two, that you would do your best to make sure that minorities were part of this building process.
Yeah, that's always been a very important part of this. And I think your use of the word promise is interesting, because I was thinking the same thing. The reason we want to get this thing built is that we made promises to the voters. And those promises were to open the casino by the end of 2012, to create 3,500 construction jobs, to create 2,000 permanent jobs. If you go back and look at the campaign for the ballot issue to move the casino, one of the issues that was discussed a lot was the redevelopment of the West Side, which I think everybody in town knows has been severely hit by the economic downturn. Mm-hmm. And we want to fulfill all of those promises.
You can see why the city is holding out. By my calculations, they stand to lose about $10 million a year. If you stayed in the township, according to reports, the casino would save $8 million a year in payments to this. They would have made to the city. And also, if you had $1,000 for each, $1,000 in income tax revenue from each of the 2,000 employees expected to work there, that comes out to about $2 million. So the city stands to lose, you know, give or take, $10 million a year.
And I should point out that the casino doesn't save the $8 million or so dollars that's designated as the host community share. It would simply go to the host
community. To the
community.
Township. Right. So we go to the township and not to the city of Columbus. 292-8513. We have a couple calls here. Let's go to Matthew. Matthew, you're on the air with Bob Tenenbaum, the spokesperson for Penn National Gaming. Go ahead.
Good morning, Bob. My name is Matt Hangeman. I'm just saying, if the city's been not dealing in good faith on the whole water and sewer services issue, why not just build a full-service wastewater treatment plant on-site, one that's actually capable of taking waste and recycling it into drinking water? Then the trucking is not an issue. The permit is the only issue, which I would think the EPA would easily grant you if it was properly designed. And, you know, I just feel for you because Columbus always holds a gun to your head and says, if you don't annex, you don't get water and sewer. I feel you're totally in the right. And what do you think about an on-site total services for wastewater and drinking water proposal?
Well, first of all, thanks for your support, Matthew. And I'm about the farthest thing from an expert on sewer and water as you could find. But I can tell you that the Ohio EPA informally has advised Penn National that it would be required to use what they call best available technology, and the implication there seems to be that that means the existing city sewer system.
Okay, so you have to. So that it's all part of the process, and the cost of a treatment plant, I guess, has got to be pretty high too. I mean,
well, I think it would, but I think there's a legal point here, mm-hmm. and I think it's an important one, and that is that this is not the typical situation that the city has been involved in recent years, where it has clearly, and I'm not saying they don't have the right to do this, in areas of new development, basically said, we will provide sewer and water service if you annex to the city of Columbus. This is a piece of property that's had city water and sewer service for almost 50 years. So we think this is a very different situation than people are used to hearing about in Columbus.
292-8513, if you'd like to talk about the Columbus Casino, the planned Columbus Casino. Bob Tenenbaum is our guest spokesperson for Penn National Gaming. To repeat, we did ask the city to take part, and they declined, politely declined, saying because of the pending litigation that they can't speak right now. Email from Angel says, why didn't Columbus raise this annexation concern before it came to a vote if they wanted tax revenue? How much might it cost to annex this land? Well, we talked about what the city stands to gain from annexing the land. Does Penn National lose anything by allowing the land to be annexed?
Well, it is a little more expensive to operate in the city than it would be in Franklin Township, but I don't think that's the real issue here. I think the real issue is that Penn National, in an effort to be a good corporate citizen, voluntarily agreed to abandon a site that it paid in excess of $30 million for in the Arena District, and then to move to the Delphi site, which I might add is one of the sites that the city recommended.
But there is an advantage. Well, first of all, many people have said the Arena District site, I'm not a developer, but the Arena District site was unworkable and was not a very good site.
It was not unworkable. I also want to point out that because it was promised in the campaign, Penn National never asked for any financial assistance for the Arena District site.
Okay. The Delphi site is bigger, allows you to do more things. You actually can build a casino resort there. So Penn National does stand to benefit financially from the West Side site, even though you had to change sites, correct?
Well, I think that's accurate. Phase two of the casino development does call for a hotel to be built on that site, for instance. That decision hasn't been made, but again, that's in phase two of the project.
There's an RV park planned.
Correct. That's also in the phase two.
I don't think you could have. There's no RV parks allowed in the Arena District, I don't think.
No, but there's also a big difference between a casino on a site such as the Delphi site and what would have been an urban casino in the Arena District, which I might add is designated, at least unofficially, as an entertainment district.
The critics say that Penn National has a pretty good deal, even regardless of this annexation. You basically have a monopoly on gambling in this part of the state. You stand to make hundreds of millions of dollars when this casino is built. You should just live up to your promises and build a casino where at the Delphi plant where you said you would.
Well, and that's exactly what we want to do, and we want to get shovels in the ground and get it built. And I should add that. The voters approved Issue 3 in 2009 based on the tax rate that was specified in the amendment. which is very competitive with states surrounding Ohio, and I think that's the important consideration. Up till now, more than in excess of $1 billion a year of Ohio money has been leaving this state to go to Indiana, to Pennsylvania, to West Virginia, to Michigan. Mm-hmm. All of those tax rates are competitive with the tax rate of 33% that's specified in the constitutional amendment.
One more question. There's a lot of money here on the table. I've always thought that there's too much money on the table for this not to get settled. What are the chances that the casino will open next year as originally planned?
I think they're very good. You know, again, we've chosen a general contractor. If the building permits are issued this week, that's a lot, that allows us.
I guess
to
what
get
are the chances that
the
you and the city reach some kind of agreement?
I don't think there. You know, that's not our goal at this point. Our goal is to get the casino built on the site that's constitutionally authorized. So, you know, we've moved beyond that.
Okay. Thanks very much, Bob Tenenbaum, spokesman for Penn National Gaming, the developer of the planned Westside Columbus Casino. Thanks very much. When we come back, we'll speak to a member, a union leader here in Columbus, who is asking that both of these sides settle their differences and get the shovels in the ground so his members can get to work. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Wednesday at noon, it's Got Gas. Find out the latest on the price of oil and get a glimpse into the future of oil in our economy. Tickets and more information at columbusmetroclub.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
It's 39 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today, some sunshine at times, and a high of 49. Clouds tonight and a low of 35 degrees. Cloudy skies for Wednesday and a high right around 62. Cloudy skies Wednesday night, a low of 46 degrees, and some clouds for Thursday, a little warmer with a high of 66. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I am Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the planned Columbus Casino, which is stuck in regulatory and legal and political gridlock. Trying to get this casino, the developer is trying to get the casino built by sometime in 2012, by next year. They're actually expecting to break ground this year. A party, besides the casino developer and the city of Columbus, who has a very big stake in this, are the workers who would build it and the folks who would work there once it's built. And joining us now is Walt Workman. He is from the AFL-CIO, and he is the executive director of the Central Ohio Labor Council. Walt, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you.
Walt, who do you blame in this fight?
I blame both parties.
Anyone more than the other?
No. As I stated at a press conference on a Tuesday a week ago, we think the both parties are at fault. And you would think that the remaining issues that are out there, that both parties could come back to the bargaining table and get those few issues remaining resolved.
Why do you think they haven't been able to reach an agreement here? There's a lot of money on the table. I mean, these casinos make, you know, let's call it $400 million a year. The city stands to gain something like $25 million a year. They seem to be squabbling over just a few million dollars when you look at all those tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that are out there waiting to be taken advantage of.
Well, we look at it, what this is going to do is going to create jobs. That's the bottom line. And we all know how devastating the economy is today. And we feel that both parties ought to be able to sit down and get a resolve. You're looking at over about 3,500 construction jobs that can go to work immediately if they would get these few remaining issues resolved. And once that is done and the casino is open, you're looking at over 2,000 permanent jobs for Central Ohio. And these are good paying jobs. and look at the revenue, then that's going to bring back into the economy on the west side of Columbus. And why they can't sit down and get the few remaining issues done, I don't understand it.
We're speaking about the planned Columbus Casino and the dispute, the ongoing dispute between the city of Columbus, Franklin County, and also the developer of the casino, Penn National Gaming. At the rally, some called on the city to change their approach.
Well, no, what I said was out there that we blame both parties.
Mm-hmm.
We did not blame the city or Penn National any more than one the other one. The problem lies between whoever's doing the negotiating for the city and who's doing the negotiating for Penn National.
But I think Bob Evans was cited at the rally that the city had offered Bob Evans, the restaurant company, a lot of incentives to stay within the city limits, and the question was raised, why can't they offer some incentives to Penn National Gaming?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, one of the other labor leaders was speaking on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
I did not make a comment, but I did read in the paper about something like $14 million that was offered. So I'm not really that familiar, so I couldn't speak on what the deal was with Bob Evans.
Do you think because the city is willing to offer incentives to Bob Evans and other companies, NetJets is holding a news conference today. There are incentives there to keep the corporate jet company in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
Does the casino deserve some kind of incentive from the city?
Well, I think the city needs to take in consideration how many jobs is this going to create permanently for the west side of Columbus. Well, not necessarily the west side, but for central Ohio. And like I said before, God knows that we need jobs in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And the revenue that the casino will bring back eventually would be, like you said, $25 million a year for the city of Columbus. And with the budget cuts that the governor is going to do, they could use the money.
Uh-huh. We're speaking with Walt Workman from the AFL-CIO. He has been a leading proponent trying to get this casino, the planned casino project off the ground and get up and running so his members can get work there. Is there anything labor can do, organized labor can do, as far as concessions on wages or anything else to help get this process going?
Well, we've called on the city and Penn National, like I said, I don't know all the issues mm-hmm. that's remaining out there. They don't tell us that part. But it would appear to me that the few remaining issues that they should be able to get them resolved.
Mm-hmm.
But you got mm-hmm. people who are lining up for those jobs, the 2,000 permanent jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to be even taking applications for another year and a half. But people want to line up to get those jobs today.
But could the union say, okay, we'll take a dollar less an hour for our members to get this thing going?
Well, I'm sure that they would. I mean, unions is taking concessions all along in order to keep corporations in business.
What do you think of the contractor that Penn National has selected, Smoot Construction?
They're a good company.
Mm-hmm.
They're a good company, yes.
Smoot
would do a good job for them.
Bob Tenenbaum just said that they're planning on they expect to get building permits, and they're planning to break ground this spring and start construction. Do you think that's going to happen?
We are in hopes that it will happen, Mike.
Do you think that it's in federal court and?
Well, we're hoping that they can come out of the courtrooms and get back into the boardrooms and negotiate in order to resolve their issues.
Mm-hmm. 292-8513, if you have a question for Walt Workman from the AFL-CIO, is the executive director of the Central Ohio Labor Council. We're talking right now about the Columbus Casino. Walt, of course, the other big story in the news, I'm sure you're quite aware, Senate Bill 5,
yes.
The bill that was signed into law by the governor last week that would drastically limit the collective bargaining power of state and actually public employee unions. Right now, you're in the referendum signature gathering stage. What is your plan to get voters to agree to overturn that bill?
Well, we're going out and talk to the citizens here in Ohio and let them make a decision. I'm a firm believer that once the referendum comes on November the 8th, that the citizens here in Ohio will overturn the bill. What the governor and this party has done will not create one job whatsoever, nor will it reduce the budget that they're facing downtown. So why the governor and the rest of the House and the Senate is coming after working people is beyond my control. I have no idea why they would do that. The only reason, in my belief, that they're trying to do this is because they want to destroy the unions. The only thing the working people have between corporations and workers is a union to represent them.
Why does a private employee, a private union employee, care about the public sector union employee?
Well, if you ever belong to a union, all brothers and sisters support the other unions. And, you know, and they are in asking for our support, and the private sectors are giving it to them. Because, you know, in the future, who knows? They may be coming after the private sector.
Might some of the members of private unions who work on, you know, private construction projects, that kind of thing, might they resent the benefits, the automatic pay increases that some public employee union members get, and may say, you know what, you know, the governor and the Republicans in the legislature, they have a point that those benefits are too generous and it's time to balance it out?
Well, if you look, you say they're too generous. If you look over the last couple of years, the concessions that those unions has given back to the state of Ohio to help eliminate the deficit. And then as far as the private sector is concerned, no, they don't resent what they're making because they know somewhere along the line during their negotiations, they have given up wages for the few benefits that they have. And over the last few years, you know, they've took concessions and gave back to the state.
So yeah. Even, you know, I don't know what a private union, you know, construction worker might make, what it might he or she might have to pay for their health insurance benefits. But when they see, you know, a public employee union member only paying 5% of or 6% of their wages towards their health insurance, there's not a little bit of a, you know, saying, well,
like, you know, the governor and the other House and the Senate, you know, maybe we ought to find out how much they're paying for their benefits. You know, what do they get that the taxpayers has to pay? Remember, they work for the taxpayers. Their salary and all their benefits is paid by taxpayers. So, you know, they don't deserve any more than what the workers do. I don't see any of them foregoing any of their pay increases or any of their benefits over the last few years.
292-8513, if you have a question for Walt Workman about the casino or about Senate Bill 5, if you want to get the union perspective on their upcoming fight this summer as the supporters of unions and Democrats try to push this Senate Bill 5 to the ballot in November. Fair share payments became a controversial topic in the past week or so. Fair share payments, they are payments made by people who do not belong to the union, but reap the benefits of union negotiation, whether it be wages, working conditions, health care benefits. Senate Bill 5 would eliminate the automatic required payments that non-union members make to unions. Why should a non-union member who works for a public agency, well, why should they be required to make union payments?
Well, they join the union when they are employed by the company. You're talking about the non-union person?
Yeah, on the public side, they don't have to join the union.
Fair share,
the fair share, yeah, they have to make the payments.
The fair share is operates like this. If you choose to be a fair share member, the money that would normally go volunteer go over to the political contributions that's made by the union or any of the political things that the unions may be involved in, that is the deducted out of whatever their union dues is. The only thing a fair share person pays is for the administration and service of the contract. So they're not paying for the political part of the union. So that's and that entitles them to be represented by the union.
But should they be required to make that automatic requirement out of
the
paycheck?
They want the benefits from the union, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the argument.
Why shouldn't they be entitled? I mean, why shouldn't they be required to pay their fair share?
What kind of campaign do you anticipate between now and November?
Well, we are planning, once they get the referendum okay by the AG and the Secretary of State's office, then we will go out and we will talk to all the citizens of Ohio and ask them to sign a petition to overturn this bill. We will explain to them what, in our opinion, what they're doing. They're taking the rights away from the working people here in Ohio. Actually, in other states, too.
Do you see this as a national referendum on unions, not just limits to public employee collective
Absolutely.
Bargaining?
Absolutely. No doubt about it, because, you know, like I said originally, what they're trying to do does not create one job, nor does it give any money to reduce the deficit of Ohio.
Given that the percentage of folks who belong to unions now is much, much less than it was,
it's about lower with 13% nationwide.
Mm-hmm. It was much lower than it was 20, 30 years ago.
35, 37.
Yeah. Do you worry that you're not going to have as many people on the union side as you did 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, you know, let's say it this way. Since this Senate bill was passed last week and signed by the governor, I have got several calls from the public itself here in my office asking how that they can get involved in getting the petition signed. And some of those are non-union people. Some of them has never belonged to the union, but they're saying they're taking the people's rights away. So I don't really foresee a major problem in getting the signatures that we need to put this on the ballot in November. And I believe once in November the 8th, when the election is, I think, in my opinion, I think it's going to be overturned.
What kind of money are we talking about for this campaign? Well, I've seen figures that it's going to be as expensive as the governor's campaign was.
Well, you know, it's hard to put a dollar figure on something that in the future, but, you know, probably I'm guessing $15, $20 million somewhere in that neighborhood.
For your side alone?
Yeah.
And that's for TV money and grassroots organizing
right, and
everything else.
Right. TV is expensive.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Tom, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I've never been a union member, never paid union dues. Our shop is half union. One side is, and I'm on the side that isn't. But I can guarantee you the reason why I have the pay I have and the benefits I have is because of the union. Proposition 5 is nothing but a union-busting bill. The governor hates unions, and he's going to do everything in his world possible to diminish union representation of public workers or private workers. Also, besides getting a referendum on the ballot to reverse Proposition 5, maybe we should also have one on there to recall the governor, because I've never seen anybody so crooked in all my life. His cabinet is made up of out-of-state people. What, we don't have good people in the state of Ohio?
I think we have Mark Kwame from out of state, and he's not in the cabinet anymore, and the other person just moved here. But let's move on to another call. And,
let me answer
this question.
Unfortunately, we are one of 18 states that do not have the recall rights.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's in Wisconsin, the fight is to recall members
right.
who voted for it. Here in Ohio, it's the fight to repeal the actual piece of legislation.
Right, but the governor in Wisconsin, they can't do that. He has to be in office for a year.
To provide some balance, let's go to Bob. You're on the air. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I've had to do with unions over the years, and unions and management are opposed to one another. And when you're talking about public employee unions, management is us, the people. So the unions are opposed to the people, plain and simple. And what the unions do is basically threaten. They threaten with political contributions. They threaten with votes. They threaten with strikes. They threaten all the way. And if it were done in any other circumstance, it would be illegal. But unions get away with it.
Let's get
so
a response.
I don't think you should have public employee unions.
Let's get a response, Bob. Thanks for the call. Walt Workman, go ahead, please.
Well, to Bob's point there, corporations spend about 30, 50 times more money in a political arena than what the unions does to get the people that they want in office. So I kind of disagree with what Bob had just said there. We don't threaten people.
Okay. Walt Workman from the AFL-CIO. He's the executive director of the Central Ohio Labor Council. Thanks very much for joining us on All Sides.
Hi, Mike. Thank you.
Coming up, a recent discovery sheds new light on the lives and deaths of Roman gladiators. That's what All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Listen to local news from the award-winning WOSU News team and national news from NPR on the new 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to enjoy the best in classical music on the new Classical 101. Classical music all day, every day. It's all news on 89.7 NPR News and all classical on Classical 101. For more information and to stream our services online, visit WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And in 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock, NPR's political junkie Ken Rudin joins all sides to discuss President Obama's decisions and the continuing battle budgets in Congress and a possible shutdown of the federal government. Join us for the political junkie on all sides, beginning at 11, here on 89.7 NPR News. And you can discover more about All Sides online at WOSU.org/All Sides. You can listen to new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. You can also find All Sides on Facebook and Twitter, subscribe to podcasts, and preview upcoming programs. Discover more about All Sides at WOSU.org/All Sides. And it's 39 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine and some clouds today, a high of 49. Clouds tonight, a low of 35 degrees, and clouds tomorrow, a high of 62. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
For most of us, when we think gladiator, we think Russell Crowe. And during the age of the Roman Empire, these ultimate fighters or gladiators were the entertainers. Now, archaeologists in England have unearthed what appears to be an ancient gladiator graveyard. We'll talk about this new discovery with National Geographic host Darius Arya. Darius is an archaeologist and also the host of this National Geographic documentary, Gladiators Back from the Dead, which airs tonight, 9 o'clock on the National Geographic channel on your cable systems. Darius, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
How was this site found? It's near York, England. How was it found?
Yeah, it's pretty much what we call typical urban archaeology. You're going to build a road. You're going to build in a new structure. And, of course, because England has many layers of history, you always have the archaeologists there as well. And they came across a very large burial site. So it's pretty much standard in urban centers in Europe to find such things. Now, this one, of course, was a little more extraordinary because of the nature of the skeleton.
Yeah, how do we know these folks were gladiators?
Yeah, well, in many ways we don't. I mean, this is all a big puzzle. It's this is what archaeology is all about. You have pieces of a puzzle, and you have certain hypotheses. And then as you move forward in time and ultimately anthropologists study the bones, then you have certain identifications of these skeletons more possible than others. So the gladiator one really does stand out. Because of the nature of some of the skeletons,
they were describe the nature of these skeletons. They were large men for the most part.
Yeah, large men. I mean, number one is when you find 80 men all buried together, that's a little anomalous. I mean, generally speaking, there's going to be the mixture of the standard demographic, men and women and children and so forth. That's a little strange. Some of them actually had these clamps around their legs still on the skeleton, so that implies that they are not freed people. And then you would think, are they slaves? But, well, you're not going to give a decent burial to a slave in the way that these were decently interred in the ground. So it implies some sort of status, and yet they're slaves. And that's when you start to think about who are the people that are slaves that had enjoyed better benefits, such as gladiators, given the quality of the skeletal types, that they seem to be athletic types, better off than most people in terms of what they ate. And ultimately, there's a lot of damage to a number of the bones, and one shoulder bone is even pierced, what looks like to be a large tooth of a cat, like a large cat, that is, like a lion or a tiger. And that's really when you start to think about, these guys might be dying in the arena, but not just slaughtered, people that are entertaining, people that are ultimately given a decent burial.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Darius Arya. He's an archaeologist and the host of the National Geographic documentary Gladiators Back from the Dead, about the discovery of a burial ground for gladiators discovered in England. There were, correct me if I'm wrong, about 1 million gladiators, but this is the first time we've discovered a skeleton of a gladiator?
Well, and again, these are guesstimates in terms of the numbers of gladiators that were in antiquity, but we do have at least 250 documented. So there were a substantial amount of gladiators from the ancient. Here and there, we do have epitaphs, but to find a large amount of burials that suggest that they are gladiators, that's extraordinary. It's one of a kind.
Mm-hmm. It's when I think of gladiators, I think of the Roman Colosseum. That's where you are
right
now. You're in Rome now.
I can see it from my house.
I don't think York, England, but there were gladiators there. I get the Romans were there, so they had to be entertained, so they were there as well.
That's the case. In fact, you know, so many times, even in recent history, amphitheaters have been found. So if you find a bunch of gladiators, chances are then there is going to be a venue. There is going to be an amphitheater. They haven't found it in York, but let's say they haven't found it yet.
Mm-hmm.
This implies, you know, 80 gladiators implies that there are going to be some sort of permanent structure for that kind of entertainment. The Romans went out and conquered, and they brought the basics with them, the baths, the roads, the aqueducts, and their own amphitheaters, the Colosseums.
Mm-hmm. And the entertainment.
What it was to be Roman. And the entertainment.
Who were these men?
Well, I mean, you know, who were gladiators? 9 times out of 10, they were slaves that were bought on the market. Maybe they had military experience. Maybe they were, you know, in good shape. They were athletic. I mean, they're an investment for the purchaser, the lanista. He wants return as investment. So he's going to obviously purchase people that he thinks he can get a return from. You know, if he can invest money and time and effort and training, this guy will perform and this guy will make him rich. And that's what it really comes down to. This is pure and simple investing in people and getting the return. It's just that today we don't want our athletes to face death like that, and that's the major difference. But of course, you can do that when you have a slave-based society.
Mm-hmm. So these folks, the retirement rate wasn't very good.
No, let's say the average life expectancy of a gladiator, professional gladiator, is about 10 years. So you are going to go around, you are going to fight, you can win, you can lose, you can draw. But you always have that possibility of facing death in the arena. That's what's so engaging and compelling today when we look at the gladiators. They can retire, and then many of them are brought out of retirement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, come back into the arena, come back for one last hurrah, and then maybe they get killed in that later stage in life. It's like athletes today. You know, it's hard for them to turn down a lot of money once they've retired because they miss the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you have with the gladiators.
But you mentioned some of these folks were slaves, so they didn't have a choice to retire.
Yes. Right. I mean, they had really nothing else to go on. I mean, and this is a better alternative. So they can't actually refuse it, right? The purchase, that's it. They're going to be trained as a gladiator. And ultimately, it's all they know. And so it's hard to leave that arena. It's hard to go on and you know, start another profession. You know, that's all that they didn't know. And it's better to burn out in the arena, let's say, than retire and be anonymous.
How accurate is the depiction of the gladiators in the Russell Crowe movie and other movies we've seen? How accurate is that?
Yeah. No, they're great. I mean, I think what's greatest about those kinds of movies is they give you the sensation, the drama, the spectacle. A lot of the tales are wrong, the costumes are wrong, and so forth. But, I mean, I do love a movie like Gladiator because it gives you a sense really, really about the drama and being there and sharing that feeling, that awe. And then these are human beings. These are people that, you know, they're trapped. You know, how can you get out of that situation? Well, you could be freed. You could be freed for good service. You could be freed by your owner. So a lot of the little bits and truths, nuggets, are there as well. So I think that's what ultimately makes it a great, compelling movie, besides the special effects and besides great acting.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Mike from Marion, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've got a question about the thumbs up, thumbs down. My understanding is thumbs down actually meant for the superior gladiator to drop his sword and let the man live, and I wondered if that's true.
This is the thumbs up and thumbs down by the member of royalty in the audience.
Exactly. I mean, really what happens is the thumbs up and thumbs down, it's really something that's perpetuated in the Hollywood movies for, you know, 50 years. So it's really coming from that. What you really have is a turned thumb, and we don't really know which way that the pollice is turned, verso. So is it turned towards me? Is it turned towards you? Is it up and down? And that's the sort of thing that is still questionable. But definitely when you're bringing it side to side, then you're talking about, and they're saying jugulatio, then that's saying, you know, slit his throat. You know, he's lost the event, and you put him out of his misery in a decent way. So some of those things are, you know, perpetuated still by the movies, and then it's hard, I think, if you're going to make a big blockbuster to not put that in. The same thing when you call it the Colosseum. I mean, nobody called it the Colosseum in antiquity. It was called the Flavian Amphitheater. But we still, if we're going to make a movie, we're going to say the Colosseum because everyone knows the Colosseum.
We're speaking with the producer, Darius Arya. He is the producer of the National Geographic special, Gladiators, Back from the Dead. It airs tonight at 9 o'clock on the National Geographic channel. He is an archaeologist as well. We're talking about the discovery of what we believe is a graveyard for gladiators found in England. How did these gladiators die? These were brutal deaths. You just mentioned slitting of the throat.
Yeah, that's a typical way to history when they're in the arena. A lot of these people in Europe were found decapitated, which is not impossible and not unheard of. But in a lot of the these bodies found decapitated actually could then be a standard way in which they're doing it there in York. I mean, there's no real guidebook as to how somebody was going to be executed. But a lot of them are going to die right in the arena. Let's say about you have a 10% chance of dying every time you're in the arena. That's a pretty high percentage. You don't have these sports like that today.
So not every match ended in the death of a gladiator. Actually 90%
didn't. They're going to come back and find another day because they are owned by somebody who's leased them out for a competition. They want a return on that investment. It's a poor investment if you're going to train somebody for a couple of years, put them in their first event, and they lose. And then they die. I mean, it just wasted a lot of money. So you got to give them a fighting chance, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you think about these long-term contracts in baseball, and the guys never produce. Imagine that if the guy just
exactly
dies his first time out. To the phones, Rod, you have a question.
Yes, you answered one of my questions there. I was wondering how often they gave him the thumbs up or thumbs down on the whether they lived or died. But my other question was, how many gladiators purchased their freedom and went on to become managers of other gladiators?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, unfortunately, we don't have the statistics for that, but we hear of it happening. It's not unheard of, but it just seems that when you finish your career, if you do become free, what can you do? So some of them become the lanista. They become the actual person that goes around and builds up their own gladiatorial school because it's what they know how to do so well. So they generally tend to stay in that arena. It's like a retired boxer, pretty good. What does he do? Maybe he opens up his own gym, something like that. So there are some kind of parallels where you kind of stay within that periphery. Or you're so wealthy you don't have to work anymore. Mm-hmm. Then you might get bored and come back out of retirement. And those are the kind of reality that you can face.
Darius Arya is an archaeologist and a National Geographic host. The documentary airs tonight on the National Geographic channel, Gladiators Back from the Dead. It talks about this discovery of an ancient graveyard in England and also uses some computer special effects to try to recreate the battles that these gladiators fought. The audience. Who was in the audience for these matches?
It's pretty much, it's actually very funny. It's really democratic. I mean, everyone can be there. It's adults, not for children. It's more for men than for women. But you could have the whole layered society. You could have slaves. You could have freed people, the poor, the wealthiest people. And then, of course, where you sit is determined by, who you are. So if you have a lot of money, do you have a lot of status, you've got the best seats. And you go higher up into the nosebleed seats, and you're less of a somebody. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what we have today.
What did the spectators expect to see when they came in? Were they hoping that one of the gladiators would die?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is it's like you go to a movie. You're going to see an action movie. You know what you want to see. You want to see blood. You want to see people killed, and then you go away and live the rest of your life. But for the gladiators, well, hey, these guys, they don't count because they're slaves. So therefore, I can get really excited about the stuff and then go off and have my dinner with my family. You've got to think about it in those terms. These aren't just bloodlusty Romans. These are people that want to be entertained and want to see great swordsmanship, skill. They want to see maybe some special effects. And that's all part of going to the amphitheater. It's also men against wild animals, not just men against beasts. It's also beast against beast. It's also execution of criminals. So all these things are going on in that venue. But the highest form, the most appreciated form, is man against man. And you can see that.
I think about the NASCAR fan who says, I don't go to a NASCAR race to see the crashes. I go to see the race. Or a hockey fan, I don't go to the game to see the fight. Were there purists back in the day who say, I don't go to these matches to see deaths. I go to see good swordsmanship.
Exactly. No, I mean, it's kind of like that. But again, you have a whole bottommost layer of society, or that's slavery. And today, what's at the bottom of society? It's machines, right? It's like the vacuum cleaner and the you know, the car wash machine and that kind of thing. So they just, you don't even think about if the thing breaks or not. You feel any remorse for that machine. And that's how the Romans, they would feel about that slave. Like, he's removed from my reality. He's not part of me. He has no right. Mm-hmm. And the irony then is that those people could get this superstar status. These people could get freed. It shows you a lot of the liberties that you actually had in the Roman society that you didn't have in any other ancient society. And that also makes it very interesting and compelling to see all these different, these inconsistencies within the society.
How long did this era last of gladiator battles?
Excuse me, sorry?
How long did this era last? Was it a couple centuries? When did it start to fade out?
Oh, well, the Romans get it from the Etruscans in about 500 B.C. is the first documentation we have it. In Rome, it's documented in the middle of the 3rd century B.C. It becomes pretty standard in the late 2nd century B.C., and it goes all the way forward until the 5th century A.D. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very long time. But then if you think about the Colosseum, it only was in use for about 400-plus years, and the rest of it's by 1,500 years, it was a ruin.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way of showing how these things kind of remain in our mindset when we talk about Rome even today, because that monument is still there.
Were they as brutal a match throughout that time period, over those centuries? Or did they become less brutal towards the end, or more brutal towards the end?
I'd almost say the opposite. I'd almost say in the beginning it was much more rudimentary. It was much more about just, okay, guys, go on there and have a good time. And over time, it develops into a sport in its own right. So you're a Thracian prisoner, and now you're going to fight in your old style. It actually becomes, I don't care where you're from, you're going to fight with this style, with this sword and this helmet.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to act in a role. Because the industry has become so big, and I need to get so many of you from so many different places. And if you're not, you're going to pretend to be one of those guys from the other part of the world. And I don't care really where you're from.
As you look at
international.
As you look at Ultimate Fighting Championship fights now, and the brutality of those, some of that entertainment desire is still there.
Oh God, yeah. I think in the end, what is so compelling about Rome is that. How different are we from them? So we drive cars and we have electricity, but the inherent nature of human beings, we're violent people, and this is one of those amazing outlets. It still engages us today because it is so incredible to think, and there are other societies in which people are pitted against, one another to the death. It's just incredibly exciting to even think about, that horrible as it is.
We'll have to leave it there. Darius Arya, he's an archaeologist and a National Geographic host of the program tonight at 9 o'clock on the National Geographic Channel. This is All Sides on WOSU.
On the next Fresh Air, the smallpox epidemic at the turn of the 20th century and the civil liberties questions raised by how the government enforced mandatory vaccinations.
There were scenes of policemen holding down men in their night robes, and inspectors were going room to room looking for children with smallpox.
We'll talk with Michael Woolrich, author of Pox.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Filmed in the scenic West, Homesteading tells the stories of pioneers who struggled to create a life for themselves on the prairies. Some failed, some scraped by, some succeeded. Watch Homesteading. It's Tuesday night. That's tonight at 10:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for